Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and happy Boxing Day. Or maybe happy day after the day you ate Chinese food and went to the movies. The Brian Lehrer Show team is off today, back live on Monday. So as 2014 comes to a close, we wanted to pause and remember a major milestone for our show. We celebrated our 25th anniversary this fall. So today we bring you some of our favorite segments from our 25 years in 25 days, then and now anniversary series, looking at different headlines and developments from the past quarter century and how they are still with us today. You can find the entire series at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show if you're interested. But let's start on the air with an excerpt from our segment on the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, 25 years ago, with the political scientist Francis Fukuyama, who published an essay that year called The End of History. We'll revisit his thinking on democracy. Then we'll get to 1998 with Maureen Dow, the New York Times columnist, who helped us remember the Clinton impeachment and talk about D.C.'s political dysfunction through a then and now lens. Is it really worse today than it was during Clinton? Restaurateur Danny Meyer and chef Dan Barber on an important turning point a decade ago for food and eating. We'll assess the golden age of television with Matthew Weiner, writer, director, producer, creator of Mad Men. Three of the all-time highest price art sales happened in 2006, so we'll hear how big money has affected New York's art scene. And finally, an excerpt from our special series concluding event at the Society for Ethical Culture in Manhattan with Gail Collins, David Remnick, and Tavis Smiley. That's all coming up right now from our 25 Years and 25 Days series here on The Brian Lehrer Show.
This is Tessa Wilson in beautiful Williamsburg, Brooklyn. You're listening to 25 Years and 25 Days on WNYC.
It's 1989.
This is a time when the future seems a door you can walk right through into a room called tomorrow.
On the east side of the Berlin Wall, soldiers dismantling it, not guarding it with rifles.
As the next mayor of this city, I say, I love New York.
The Exxon Valdez had just loaded more than a million barrels of Alaskan crude.
All the power and excitement of Nintendo, introducing Game Boy.
Can you believe it?
It's the Brian Lehrer Show as we begin our series 25 Years in 25 Days, then and now, today, 1989, all to commemorate the 25th anniversary of this program, which was September 25th, 1989, or at least that was the debut. Now we are beginning our 26th year. And in 1989, as communism was getting ready to collapse, political scientist Francis Fukuyama published an essay in the National Interest that made a very bold assertion about what was happening in the world. Quote, "The universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government." That's what he said was emerging in 1989. The universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. What an assertion that any ideology would become universal, or that any form of government would be the final form of human government, and that history would literally end in that respect. He was on the show to talk about it in our early years. I talked to Francis Fukuyama again, and I asked him, so did history end in 1989?
Well, okay, let's begin. This is not a good year. I think democracy is in trouble in a lot of places, and I think authoritarianism is on the move, as well as various forms of nationalism and religious extremism. And so I think that, you know, I never really argued that there's some kind of an automatic mechanism that's going to get us to the universalization of democracy. We have ups and downs, and right now we have really serious challenges, I think, at both ends of Eurasia from Russia and China. But I do think you need to separate the, you know, what I would say is the short term question of today's challenges from the longer term question. What are the models out there that countries want to follow? Are people going to try to emulate Russia? Now, you know, Mr. Orban in Hungary wants to emulate Mr. Putin, but I think in general, Putin's model is so dependent on petrodollars and internal corruption that it's not really an attractive form of government. The Chinese, I think, have got a more plausible case, but very few countries can imitate China. So I think we need, you know, despite these very real threats in places like Ukraine and in the Middle East, I think we still have to bear in mind that two-thirds of the world's countries still aspire to organize themselves democratically. And as a realistic option for governance in the future, I think that's still a very powerful contender.
You noted in that essay that the end of history had been declared before by Hegel in 1806 after Napoleon won the Battle of Jena. He thought the French Revolution ideals of liberté and equality were conquering the world, which is, I guess, similar to what you said in 89, but there turned out to be a lot of history between 1806 and 1989, didn't there? Little things like communism, fascism, and Nazism, for example. Did that give you pause about making your prediction?
Well, no. Actually, you know, that's in a way why I did it, because in a certain sense, you have to see through to the larger trends. And I think one of the brilliant things that Hegel realized at that point was that the ideals of the French Revolution, that is to say a regime based on a combination of the principles of liberty and equality, would be a very powerful form of government, even if it wasn't universal or there are alternatives and so forth. And in many respects, all of the Sturm und Drang of the two world wars and the rise of communism and so forth can be seen as preparing the way for the emergence of democracy down the road, because the idea was really set back then. So I think even though it obviously sounds absurd to say that history ended in 1806, you need to look underneath that at what, you know, what the intention was. And I think the idea was the thing that was constant.
At least the big challenges to it in the 20th century all seemed to fail. And rereading the essay this week, I was struck by one central idea in it that I think people didn't focus on much back then in 89, that Western democracy and Western capitalism had defeated communist totalitarianism largely because the class issue, Marx's main issue, class, was receding in the West. You wrote, "The egalitarianism of modern America represents the essential achievement of the classless society envisioned by Marx." Wow. I mean, was that the wrongest part of your analysis? Because perhaps the biggest issue today in the United States is economic inequality.
Well, I think that's right. But I think it's also the case that reality has changed. I think that since 1989, we've actually seen a very dramatic increase in economic inequality in the United States. And I would never make that statement today, because I do think that actually you know, the 1% and the 99% is probably one of the biggest social challenges we face, and that, in fact, democracy is not going to survive if the de facto distribution of income continues to get skewed in this fashion. So, you know, you have to take the world as you see it, and things are, you know, they're very different right now.
So if class is back, in what way might that mean history is back, or what might the competitor be to democracy slash capitalism when you couldn't envision any potential competitors in 1989?
Well, this is actually, I think, a really acute problem for the left around the world, because they've got a good case that income is badly distributed, that you have oligarchies arising in many parts of the world, and what's the solution to that? And I think that everybody on the left realizes if you simply go back to these old socialist solutions of pure redistribution and public ownership of the means of production, that you're not going to grow, you're not going to innovate technologically, you're not going to be able to keep up in this global competitive race, but you need to do something about it. And I think one of the weaknesses of the left is that there hasn't been a new Karl Marx. I mean, I think Thomas Piketty aspires to be, but I'm not sure that his practical solutions to this problem are actually that practical. And I think what the left needs is a clearly articulated agenda around which people can mobilize that will in some way deal with the inequality problem and not kill growth. And I think that just hasn't been, that formula hasn't been invented yet.
Francis Fukuyama. Now, one more clip from that interview. I asked Fukuyama if ideological history is really over, as he asserts. What about the persistence of Islamist extremism, the dream of the caliphate that was in its own form 10 years old in Iran in 1989, being expressed again today, obviously and shockingly, by ISIS, a competing ideology to Western liberal democracy, to be sure? No?
Actually, I don't think so. I think that in the end, this is not the biggest long-term threat to democracy, because I think the appeal that it has is to disaffected, jobless young men who really can't assimilate into their societies, and that's why they end up making this pilgrimage to Syria to actually give some purpose and meaning to life. But none of these groups has really proven that they can actually run a big industrialized, modernized country like China. I mean, the Chinese communists have shown that they can do this, but I think there's a kind of inherent tension between this kind of reactionary religious conservatism and the needs of running a modern society. So they can do a lot of damage. They can kill people. If they get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, we'll all really regret it. But as a civilizational challenge, I just don't think that it's on the same level as some of the challenges that we've seen in the 20th century.
Francis Fukuyama, who wrote the End of History essay in 1989 in a conversation that we recorded this fall. We're commemorating the 25th anniversary of this show with some of our favorite segments from our 25 years and 25 days series. Up next, Maureen Dowd on 1998, the Clinton impeachment and D.C. dysfunction then and now. Stay with us. Today's show is a collection of excerpts from our 25 years and 25 days anniversary series from this fall. We're re-airing some of our favorite segments from the series, assessing the past quarter century, and you can find the entire series on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Our comments page is always open, and you can also tweet at Brian Lehrer or check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC.
This is Daniela from the Lower East Side. You are listening to 25 Years in 25 Days on WNYC.
It's 1998.
Then I realized no one had told her about the end of love in Manhattan. Welcome to the age of uninnocence.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
On the University of Wyoming campus, where Matthew Shepard was a freshman, students are wearing yellow ribbons today.
As you know, the Justice Department and 20 state attorney generals today have filed lawsuits against Microsoft Corporation.
I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude.
In 1998 was the year that President Bill Clinton was impeached. Remember that impeachment is his indictment by the House of Representatives. That happened, even though he was acquitted by the Senate. And one of those impeaching congressmen was a young Republican from South Carolina named Lindsey Graham.
Today, Republicans, with a small handful of Democrats, will vote to impeach President Clinton. Why? Because we believe he committed crimes resulting in cheating our legal system. We believe he lied under oath numerous times, that he tampered with evidence, that he conspired to present false testimony to a court of law. We believe he assaulted our legal system in every way. Let it be said that any president who cheats our institutions shall be impeached.
Lindsey Graham, then just a 33-year-old second-term congressman. Let's get a take on 1998 from New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, who won a Pulitzer for her columns on the Clinton-Lewinsky year of the impeachment. Hi, Maureen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Do you remember what you first thought when you heard about the Clinton-Lewinsky affair? Did you think the president would have to resign?
No. It was a very strange time in Washington. It was almost like Midsummer Night's Dream, where the whole city was gripped with this crazy fever, where you knew, you know, the idea of impeaching the president over something that so many politicians have done here for centuries was nuts. You know, my brothers grew up as pages in the days of when Richard Nixon and JFK were senators, and they had to, you know, make up excuses for politicians all the time to their wives when they answered the phone in the cloakroom. And it was just this craziness.
In historical context, 10 years earlier, in the 1988 presidential campaign, Gary Hart got run out of the race when word of his affair with Donna Rice became public. And 10 years later, when Elliot Spitzer's prostitution scandal broke, a much less serious matter by most people's standards, I think, he did resign immediately. So how did the Clinton machine, and so much of your reporting was on the Clinton machine, manage to slow down the frenzy enough to even put up a fight?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I was going to mention Gary Hart because he and Monica Lewinsky seem like the only two people who were sort of flies in amber, you know, these permanent kind of victims, Hart of the press and Monica of the Clintons. And everyone else kind of has moved on and is beyond shame. And Bill is more popular than ever. But so your question is how the Clinton machine...
Things were going so fast right. on those first days.
Right.
You know, the Sunday talk shows were speculating about resignation. So they managed to slow down the frenzy enough to put up an extended fight.
Yeah, that's true. But also, at some level, the idea that they should be impeached. I mean, Newt Gingrich was, you know, supporting impeachment while he was having an affair with a young woman he'd met on the Hill who he, you know... So there was so much hypocrisy about the whole thing, and the Republicans knew it, that, you know, their case was just ridiculous. And Ken Starr was the one who seemed like the heavy-breathing sex addict. You know, the Starr Report was like a 500-page Harold Robbins novel. So, you know, I just think the Clintons are brilliant at fighting back, and they did do a horrible thing in sort of painting Monica as Hillary recently, it turned out in Diane Blair's papers, she wrote that Hillary called her a narcissistic Looney Tune, and people were painting her as a troubled young woman to try and save Bill, and that was low, looking, but effective.
And looking back, you wrote in January of 98, which was just the very beginning of it, January, that, quote, Hillary isn't throwing Bill's stuff out on the White House lawn because she is as committed to their repugnant arrangement as he is. Why did you use repugnant then? I realize it was a long time ago. And do you still consider it a repugnant arrangement now?
Yes, because I think that Hillary was part of the damage control. The damage control was to paint Monica as a troubled young woman. They couldn't just say, they should have just said, and, you know, at one point Bill Clinton asked Dick Morris to poll on this, whether he should just tell the truth, and Dick Morris told him not to. They should have just said, yes, he had an affair with this young woman, and he's sorry. I'm sure he still could have gotten through it, but instead they demonized her. And the feminists, who ordinarily should be supporting her, all went on the side of Bill and Hillary because he represented so many progressive policies for women. So they sort of sacrificed Monica on the altar of these progressive policies. So he was doing regressive male behavior but got away with it because of his progressive qualities. And people just shouldn't be in that situation where they have to choose between a man's policies and his bad treatment of a young woman who worked for him.
So those were the repugnant political compromises, but I got the sense that when you referred to their repugnant arrangement, you meant something about their marriage, no?
No, I meant their demonization of Monica. I think if he, you know, wants to act like a teenager on the Titanic running around the boat with Monica, then if he gets caught, he should just admit what he did and ask for forgiveness. I think their tendency to demonize his mistresses when the mistresses were telling the truth is repugnant.
Here is perhaps the most famous Hillary Clinton moment from 1998 when she went on the Today Show shortly after the scandal broke in January. to put it in her chosen political context.
Look at the very people who are involved in this. They have popped up in other settings. This is the great story here for anybody willing to find it and write about it and explain it, is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president. A few journalists have kind of caught on to it and explained it, but it has not yet been fully revealed to the American public.
So a crackly old version of the vast right-wing conspiracy. What did you think of that at the time, and what do you think of it now?
Well, I think there was this huge, horrible Republican movement against him, which is ironic because Newt Gingrich clearly had a boy crush on him. Bill O'Reilly says today that the only reason Hillary should get elected is because you get Bill, and Bill knows what he's doing. So Republicans have so much more respect for him and worked with him. Even during impeachment, he would sneak over Newt Gingrich so they could work together, you know, on the budget or whatever. So, you know, Republicans seem to have so much more respect for him than they do for President Obama, and yet they were after him in this horrible way. So she's right about that. But, you know, that's a separate issue from how the Clinton machine dealt with women who accused Bill, or not
right.
even, I'm sorry, Monica did not accuse him, with women who it turned out he had been involved with. They were ruthless, you know.
And you also declared back then, and it was so fun, Maureen, to go back and read your old columns from 98.
Oh, thank you.
That Bill Clinton had determined his own place in history. He will be remembered as the pre-APIC president. So I had to look up pre-APIC yesterday. But I see it basically means he's always erect. And yet that's probably not the top item in most people's minds about him anymore.
That's so funny. I also got to use the word satiriasis, which is probably the only time I'm going to get to use that. But, you know,
did you use pre-APIC on purpose to make people look it up and say, oh, that?
I know. I do like to do that. I'm sorry to admit. But the joke about Bill Clinton is when he drives through a car wash in a convertible with the top down, somebody else gets wet. And, you know, he is the first president in history to sort of go through something, a scandal like that, and come out on the other side. He is now more popular than he has been at any time except at the very beginning of his presidency. And in many instances, he's had to help out President Obama, you know, to sell his policies and explain, you know, President Obama called him the Secretary of Explaining Stuff.
For that amazing speech, one of the most amazing political speeches I've ever seen at the 2012 Democratic Convention.
Yes. So he's bigger than ever. And, you know, again, he's going to have to kind of drag another cerebral candidate up the hill with Hillary. So even David Axelrod told me that Bill Clinton is the most seductive character that we've seen in American politics in our lifetime. And partly it's that resilience. People are just, and partly it's the happy warrior thing, the desire to get up every day and go at it, no matter how difficult. You know, that unfailing belief that in the future things will be better, and the zest in the hand-to-hand combat of politics and policy. And people compare that to Obama, and even James Carville said, you know, about President Obama, it's amazing that a man can be so successful. It's something he doesn't really like. It's like if you found out that Peyton Manning didn't like to play football. So, I think we're craving a president who really wants to try. In some ways, it seems like President Obama has stopped trying.
You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. It's 25 years and 25 days, our anniversary series here on The Brian Lehrer Show. The year is 1998 with the impeachment saga, but we're going to tie it to today as well with New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, as we're trying to do throughout the series. And Maureen, when people say that today is the most polarized moment in Washington in memory, I think we sometimes forget how crazy partisan it was during the Clinton years. And I wonder how you would compare today's polarization to 1998, when we were all, in a way, saying the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, William Safire always used to write that back in the days of Lincoln, you know, it was horrible too, and people are, reporters are just ahistorical. But I do think that to a certain extent, it's more broken than I've ever seen it. And certainly President Obama does not have the temperament to try and break through. I think someone like Bill Clinton would. But I do think that the Iraq War had something to do with it. I think that, you know, in some ways, W took the family station wagon and crashed it into the globe on that one. Mm. Because when you take the country into a fake war, and people like Hillary Clinton helped him do that, you know, in a way, it just breaks the system. I mean, I do think the system is broken for other reasons, but I don't think that helped.
Right. But then, in theory, the country should have been ready to be unified by Barack Obama, but it didn't happen. And here is a clip of Bill Clinton in 2009, the first year of the Obama presidency, on the Obama hate that was already springing up. David Gregory asked the question on Meet the Press.
Your wife famously talked about the vast right-wing conspiracy targeting you. As you look at this opposition on the right to President Obama, is it still there?
Oh, you bet. Sure it is. It's not as strong as it was because America's changed demographically, but it's as virulent as it was. I mean, they're saying things about him. You know, it's like when they accused me of murder and all that stuff they did. But it's not really good for the Republicans of the country what's going on now. I mean, they may be hurting President Obama. They can take his numbers down. They can run his opposition up. But fundamentally, he and his team have a positive agenda for America. Their agenda seems to be wanting him to fail. And that's not a prescription for a good America.
So President Clinton in 2009. And Maureen Dowd, that was just months into the Obama administration. And, you know, in the 2008 primaries, when Obama supporters said one reason to vote for him would be that Hillary was too polarizing historically and Obama could bring the nation together, I actually never believed it because I never thought it was about Hillary. It's because that's how the Republicans fight. Do you think that's the right way to look at it?
Yes, I think you're right. And, you know, I think that different developments in politics like the Tea Party has made it really hard because someone like Boehner, Speaker Boehner, I do think left to his own devices would be much more cooperative with President Obama. I'm sure they would be golfing and putting some things together. But unfortunately, he got yanked on a leash by the Tea Party and couldn't even follow his own natural instincts. So you know, we're just living in a really, it's sad because President Obama had said we didn't have to be this red and blue nation, but we do. And that's how, you know, all our media is set up too on TV, and it's exhausting.
More and more. And so to speculate about the future a little bit, Hillary Clinton is seen so much differently now than when she was first lady, more of a hawk, more of a pro, more of a centrist.
Right.
Do you think she, of all people, ironically, has the potential to end the culture wars era if she's elected president?
You know, I just don't know. And I think the horrible thing I've learned covering all these presidencies is that you don't know during a campaign. W promised to have a humble foreign policy, and it didn't work out that way. Barack Obama promised to unite the country, and it didn't work out that way. So I don't think we know what a president is going to be like until it happens. And as Harold Macmillan said, events, dear boy, events, you know, the events and the enormous pressure of the White House come to bear. But I think the open question to me about Hillary is, has she learned lessons from the horrible things that she's gone through? When health care failed, did she learn that if she had made the compromises her husband recommended, she could have gotten health care, and that being stubborn and defensive are not good traits, you know? And has she learned lessons from the bad things that have happened, or has it just made her more defensive and scarred? And I think it's very hard to tell until people become president, because they are basically, Warren Beatty once said that politicians are like actors, but they never get to change their roles. And so That's what makes them crazy, because they're stuck in the same role. So they're acting during a campaign and saying things, but that doesn't turn out to be the way they behave, unfortunately.
New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd, thanks for helping us out on 25 years in 25 days, looking back, looking sideways, looking forward. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. You're the best.
We go out with the Billboard number one song of 1998. It's Too Close by Next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and our 25 years and 25 days excerpt special today continues with a look at food and 2004. You can find our entire series online at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But food and 2004. In an article about restaurants that opened 10 years ago, the New York Times noted that 2004 was like 1967 and 1991 in music, or 1939 and 1999 in film. In hindsight, it seems, in short, pivotal. The list of important restaurants that opened 10 years ago is long enough to make us think it's got to be more than coincidence. The Spotted Pig, Per Se, Masa, Freeman's, Franny's, Spice Market, the Momofuku Noodle Bar. It was the year Danny Meyer opened the first Shake Shack in Madison Square Park. It was the year executive chef and co-owner Dan Barber opened Blue Hill at Stone Barns, the farm-to-table restaurant that is so literal it's actually at a farm in Westchester. So let's talk about eating then and now, and how your own kitchen has changed in similar ways, perhaps, with Danny Meyer and Dan Barber. Danny Meyer is the head of the Union Square Hospitality Group and author of Setting the Table, The Transforming Power of Hospitality in Business. Hello. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. How are you?
Good, thank you. And Dan Barber is chef at Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Westchester. He's also the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food, and chef at Blue Hill here in New York City. Hey, Dan.
Hello, good morning.
Could we start with a little bit of 2004 background from each of you, Dan Barber? Why did Blue Hill at Stone Barns open that year?
Because Mr. Rockefeller said it should, so... But it was 10 years in the making, really, and Mr. Rockefeller came to Blue Hill, New York City. I think he had a good meal, and we started talking about opening a restaurant in the middle of a farm. My brother is my co-owner of Blue Hill, and my sister-in-law is the designer, and he green-lighted this project that turned into a farming operation, education center, and a restaurant all in one.
And Danny Meyer, why Shake Shack in 2004?
Shake Shack was really an accident that connected with the refurbishment of Madison Square Park, and we had just gotten to the point with the Madison Square Park Conservancy of saying that now that we've made this park beautiful with horticulture and, you know, children's activities and safe, what we really need is a reason for people to come use the park. And so we decided to launch an art program in the park, and the first art exhibit in 2001 asked us to do a working hot dog cart to go with these taxi cabs on stilts. And we did that. We agreed to do it, and we did it out of the kitchens of 11 Madison Park. And 3 years of this hot dog cart with lines you couldn't believe encouraged us to turn the hot dog cart into a 20-foot by 20-foot
kiosk. See, if only Mr. Rockefeller had asked for hot dogs.
You'd be in good shape.
Yeah, right.
Pigs in the blanket.
Farm-grown hot dogs.
Yeah.
And how would you each explain what was happening in 2004 that so many significant restaurants opened? We've spent this whole show talking about all the things that were happening that year, just 3 years after 9/11 and with a war going on, and yet such a big moment for social media and other things domestically. What was in the air? Or was it just a coincidence, Dan Barber?
Well, it's also interesting to know how many restaurants closed that year of well-known and famous restaurants, La Caravelle, Lutèce, La Côte Basque, I think, closed that same year. And these were restaurants that I grew up not only admiring, but learning how to cook from that kind of that kind of aesthetic and that kind of tradition. And really, 2004 marked the beginning of fine dining being turned on its head, not just through the Shake Shacks of the world, but also through fine dining restaurants that were once white tablecloth restaurants that became informal and approachable and changed forever the way we think about dining in fine dining restaurants.
And Danny Meyer, same question. And, you know, the Times write-up suggested some of it might have been post 9/11, in fact, that people were ready to eat and enjoy time out again, as well as that there was more capital floating around a few years in the post 9/11 recovery.
Yeah, there's so many molecules that are part of this story, and one that I think gets missed sometimes is something that happened in 2003. You got to remember that restaurants have a gestation period that's longer than elephants. It's generally, you know, 1 to 2 years, and so in 2003. A really remarkable thing happened in Paris, which is that Joël Robuchon opened his Atelier de Joël Robuchon. He had been on the sidelines for a few years before that, having, you know, succeeded with three-star Michelin-star restaurants. And Robuchon said, hold on, I'm going to do the ultimate in high-low and serve three-star Michelin food in a bar setting. And people took notice of that, and they said, wait a minute, we can eat food that is as good as the fancy places that Dan Barber just reminded us closed in 2004. We can eat awesome food, but in a low kind of setting as opposed to the fancified, formal, tuxedo-clad waiter setting. Momofuku took that upon itself to go with that. In 2004, 2005, we opened the Modern, the bar at the Modern, completely prompted by the experience of eating at Robuchon in Paris with small plates at a high level. And then you get an opportunity to say, we've had this huge recession, this fear after 2001. We want comfort. We want really, really good food, but we don't want fancy because it just doesn't feel right. And you get this explosion of places that allow you to eat great food, but without the pomp and circumstance going with it, like Momofuku.
Somebody posted a comment on our website that reminds us that another thing that took place in 2003 was the Bloomberg smoking ban, and wonders if that could have contributed to the explosion of significant restaurant openings in 2004. Dan Barber, do you think so?
I don't know.
I mean, yours was in Westchester, but
yeah,
still.
We had a no-smoking policy already, so we might have been ahead of that.
Danny Meyer, anything there?
Well, we had eliminated smoking at Union Square Cafe in 1990, so I think that the best thing about the Bloomberg smoking ban is that for all the people who said this is going to kill the restaurant and bar industry, they were completely wrong. It actually made it so much more pleasant to go out and eat in New York City. I don't know that that contributed to why we had this boom, but I just love the fact that it didn't do the opposite.
I want to play a clip, an archival clip from this show. This is actually from 2003 when we went on the road and did the show one day from, of all places, a Whole Foods in Edgewater, New Jersey. And we were joined for part of that show by Dr. Joan Gussow, thought of as the patron saint of the modern locavore movement, local food movement. And since we've been talking about all sorts of different issues from that time and the connection between food and politics and culture, here is a minute that we re-listened to the other day and thought it might still be worth a listen.
Oh, what do people know about in this country? They know about what's on television. Right at the moment, they know about Iraq. When that blows over, we'll have some other thing they can focus on. We don't get told much in this country.
You know, you said Iraq. People only know what's going on in Iraq because we focus on one thing at a time. You told my producer a very interesting thing. Repeat it for the crowd, that we have no idea, with all that we're hearing about Iraq, what they grow there.
Oh, boy. Now you have really, really hit on something that is my... I think the invisibility of food... We're obsessed with food. As a country, we're obsessed with food. There's food on every corner. There's so many restaurants in New York, you can't imagine how they all make a living. But we know not one damn thing about food. We just don't. It's kept from us. Do you know that most of the farmers in the United States, the medium-sized farmers are going broke? Do you know that grain prices are lower than they were in the Depression? I mean, Do you know all this?
We'll pick it up. Right?
So John Gus Allen, the patron saint of the locavore movement, when we did the show from a Whole Foods in Edgewater one day.
Was that an audio? That was a, where was that, in a theater? Or it sounded like
it was in a Whole Foods.
In the middle of a Whole Foods.
We did it in the store. Yeah. And shoppers were coming by, and of course they had advertised it for days, so we had chairs set up. There was a live audience, and people, it wasn't one of those where people sat down for 2 hours and watched the show. People were coming and going. It was actually really cool. But Dan Barber, you're a chef who knows the cows where your restaurant's butter comes from.
Yeah.
You know your carrots and what piece of earth they were in. Do you agree with that assessment that in 2003 people just didn't know anything about where their food came from? And has that changed significantly?
Yeah, it's a different era. I mean, that really feels like a big flashback. I mean, at that time, she's right. I hate to sound like my grandfather, but back in those days, people were really ignorant, not only of where our food was coming from, but who was growing it, how it was getting to us. And that those times have changed more dramatically than can be expressed in words, I think. I mean, the world is different. People are not only interested, but they demand to know where their food is coming from. So a restaurant like Stone Barns and the Union Square Farmers Market, which Danny Meyer is very responsible for making as famous as it is today, is all about people wanting to reconnect with where their food comes from.
And so, Danny, if I've got my history right, you opened Gramercy Tavern 20 years ago in 1994 as a restaurant with a seasonal menu, and so you were onto something like that even then.
Well, thanks for saying that, both of you. And I think Union Square Cafe, which opened in 1985, even preceded that, because, you know, we never wore it on our shirt sleeve, but the very reason that Union Square Cafe exists where it exists, a stone throw from the farmer's market, was to be able to do what Dan then took to, you know, a much, much higher level by being able to grow this stuff yourself. So I think I'm not sure I agree with Joan Gussow saying in 2003 people didn't really know about food, because I remember from the American Institute of Wine and Food in the early days, 1985, 86, 87, we were starting to get to the point where there were seminars popping up all over the city. True, it may have been a much smaller army of people who were expressing that interest and that knowledge, but it was there, and I think it didn't. I think it didn't have to wait to start till.
But it's bled into the culture now in a way that it wasn't part of the consciousness, everyday consciousness then, right?
And on our comments page, Jim writes, "My home kitchen has changed in the last 10 years, which now incorporates modernist tools and techniques, homegrown ingredients, and mostly locally sourced meat and produce." So do you think what started in restaurants affected people's home cooking, or was it kind of more simultaneous? We just have 30 seconds left.
I think that's the history of restaurants in this country, and actually restaurants throughout the world. They are top down, not to sound too Republican about it, but they are top down. These trends start from chefs' kitchens and from dining rooms, and they ultimately inculcate themselves into everyday dining habits in people's homes and beyond. So I think that's a good trend for American food for the future. I think we're looking at better food in the future.
In 2004, Dan Barber, who was just speaking, opened Blue Hill at Stone Barns. Danny Meyer opened the first Shake Shack in Madison Square Park in 2004. He's also the man behind Union Square Cafe, Blue Smoke, Gramercy Tavern, and others. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And as we end, as we've been doing throughout this 25 years and 25 days series, we go out with the top Billboard Song of the Year, and in 2004, it was Yeah by Usher. Today's show is a collection of excerpts from our 25 Years and 25 Days anniversary series from this fall. We're re-airing some of our favorite segments from the series, assessing the past quarter century, and you can find the entire series on our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Our comments page is always open, and you can also tweet at Brian Lehrer or check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/BrianLehrerWNYC.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show, celebrating 25 years in 25 days. I'm Ray, calling from the Queensbridge Arts Area in Queens.
Today, it's 2006.
Eduardo Cunero,
this
It's about immigration reform. If we all work on this, we will make a change.
And I see that what has happened to Sean Bell can happen to anyone.
The assumption is something like this. The Earth is so big, we can't possibly have any lasting harmful impact on the Earth's environment. And maybe that was true at one time, but it's not anymore.
And most fundamentally, changing the culture of a government, and Albany in particular, that has run amok.
Thank you, Mr. Spitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Spitzer. And in November 2006, Jackson Pollock's No. 5, 1948, became the most expensive painting ever sold. On Wikipedia's inflation-adjusted list of the highest known prices paid for paintings, three of the top five prices were paid in 2006. David Geffen sold the Pollock, as well as de Kooning's Woman 3 that year, and the Noy Gallery purchased Klimt's portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer that year as well for over $100 million. So the question is, what has that kind of money meant for New York's art world, for the galleries, for the museums, for the art, for the would-be artists, for culture itself? I'm joined by WNYC's art critic Deborah Solomon for this, and we will hear from artist Eric Fischel, who has turned the tables and depicts a piece of the changing art world in his latest work, The Art Fair. He'll tell us about that. But first, welcome back, Deborah Solomon.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good, thank you. And were you shocked by the prices paid for those paintings that year, 2006?
Well, no, not really, because there are always high prices knocking down other high prices in the art world. And what's interesting about the Gustav Klimt, when that went for $100 million, $140 million actually, it only remained the top price for 4 months, because 4 months later, the Pollock that you just mentioned came along and sold for more than the Gustav Klimt.
And so I wonder what was more shocking, the sheer numbers, $140 million for the Pollock, or that these were 20th century paintings?
Yeah. Well, I think there has been an enormous rush to collect contemporary art and modern art in the past few years since 2006. And the question is, why is contemporary art, which no one wanted to look at for much of the 20th century, now so desirable at auction? And the main shift that I see as a result of all of this is that less business is being done in galleries, more is being done in auction houses and at art fairs, and there seems to be this atmosphere of public spectacle around the art world right now. There is always a fair going on, and I miss the days when people went to a gallery and sat down in a quiet room with a dealer and talked about what was on the walls. Instead now, art viewers are more likely to go to these carnivals that are always taking place in New York. The print fair is opening next on November 5th at the Armory. And we also have the art fair, the art show, the Armory show, the outsider art fair, the affordable art fair. It's just a constant string of fairs.
The affordable art fair. I'll go to that one.
Yeah, it's not that affordable. I have to warn you.
Everything's relative.
Exactly.
Is this a bad thing?
Well, I think it would be pious of me to pretend that money is bad for art. I certainly don't glorify the days when artists lived on crusts of bread and starved in garrets. We want artists to live well. But I think the problem is that the money has become so much the center of focus that we can't see anything else. We look at paintings, we see dollar bills dancing in front of them. And to me, the whole rise of the art fair and the idea of collecting as a popular pastime has
become more impossible for more people.
No, it's just overshadowed the art. So if you ask me what is the greatest cultural artifact since 2006, yes, I would say it's not a particular painting or sculpture. It is the rise of the art fair and the insane amounts of money that are being spent on art.
And we have an image of the Klimt painting on our website. Listeners, if you want to see that and be reminded of what $135 million can get you today, go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show. But this is a perfect point on which to bring in artist Eric Fischel, because he's got a show in London now of his paintings of art fair patrons. And we've got images of two of those paintings on our website as well, folks, if you want to just see for your pleasure or kind of follow along and understand even a little more of what we're talking about at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Eric Fischel, hi. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me on.
What drew you to art fair patrons as a subject?
That's a tough one. I think it was the realization that they're not going to go away. And because they're not going to go away, I thought I better take a look at them. I'd been trying to deny them as part of my art practice and my sense of art purpose and for a very long time, and it just wore me down.
For people who don't even know the institution of an art fair, would the people going to art fairs who you were trying to resist be different from, say, people going to museums to look at art?
No, I mean, I don't have a particular collector in mind when I make work, or, you know, don't have a particular collector in mind when I have somebody buy the pieces. But I have an ideal sense of that, which is something that is a more intimate exchange. And, the problem with making art and selling art is that artists make art out of love, and they're asking for love in return. And what they get in return is neutral currency. They get money. And then they have to figure out a way of turning that neutral currency into something that sort of satisfies their need for love. And that happens, you know, you can do it in the beginning when you don't have money. It's easy to sort of turn things into love because you can buy a house for security, which makes you feel good. You can buy toys and stuff, and then there becomes a point where you have excess neutral, and then all of a sudden the exchange becomes much more complicated.
And Deborah Solomon, maybe you saw the David Byrne post recently. "I don't care about contemporary art anymore," was the title, in which he says the sheer amount of money in the market now affects how he sees the art. He walks into a gallery and thinks, quote, "inoffensive tchotchkes for the billionaires and the museums they fund."
Yeah, that's a little bit sweeping, don't you think so, as far as generalizations go? I think it is up to us as viewers, as art lovers, as thinking people, to look past the dollars and the 1% that is buying the most expensive paintings on the market and look for signs of genuine feeling and originality in art. So I haven't stopped looking at contemporary art.
Eric Fischel, I know you were part of the Soho art world for many years, but you left for Sag Harbor. I'm curious, if you were just starting out today, do you ever wonder where you would head? Is it Bushwick? Is it Pittsburgh? Where do you think?
Probably Detroit. It's a great opportunity for people with very little money, it's a place that's so desperate and that it needs the kind of passion and intelligence and creativity that the art community brings to an environment. So,
is it happening? Is there a bohemian scene springing up in Detroit now because the city is in such bad shape that new people can afford to live there?
They're actually giving away houses. There's a program. They will give you a free house if you are an artist and plan to make art in your house in Detroit.
Fascinating. You're listening to WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Deborah Solomon, one recent phenomenon that we've noticed here is all the waiting in line for selfies at art rooms or events like Marina Abramovich or Rain Room at MoMA, the Kusama Infinity Room in Chelsea, Kara Walker's Subtlety in the Domino Sugar Factory this summer. Does it mean anything artistically, or is it just that people are taking selfies everywhere, so here too?
Well, I think like the art fair, the phenomenon of taking selfies at museums allows for a degree of viewer participation that at times seems to be the point of the display. If the art isn't strong enough, then the selfie becomes the point of the exhibition. And we might end up in the 20th century with just zillions and zillions of selfies and no art. That's a worst-case scenario.
Which actually makes me think of the show for which Marina Abramović was on this program recently, Mutual Gaze. She was here last year, and I'm going to play a clip. And for people who don't know, Mutual Gaze was basically that the patrons would sit with the artist, and they would look at each other. And here's Marina on the show talking about it.
I didn't have no idea that I will have this kind of reaction on the public. I have 1,750 people sitting in the front of me on any amount of time, everything between 15 minutes to 7 hours. Not only that the people was sitting, but they was waiting. Waiting became part of the process. The people not just wait in the museum, but wait outside and sleep through the night and come to just to the sit in front of me.
So was that the ultimate selfification of the art world, or something more profound happening there? She certainly experienced it as profound.
I think that it does represent the selfification and the interactivity of culture at its most insane peak. And what's interesting is her show is called The Artist is Present. I feel like the artist is always present. Is she saying Van Gogh isn't present in his paintings? We don't need the artist's body in order to understand art, Brian. We can connect with the artist through their work. And what I'm seeing is a kind of new literalness where people don't feel like, artists feel like they don't have to necessarily transform their feelings into a material form. They bring us the artist himself or herself. And that's an act to me completely devoid of metaphor or the transforming powers of art.
WNYC art critic Deborah Solomon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And thank you, Eric Fischel. His art fair paintings are up in London. We have a link on the website for any of our listeners there where he depicts the patrons at the art fairs. But also, he curated a show here in the city at the Flag Art Foundation. We have that address and a link on our webpage as well. Eric, do you want to say a word about that?
Yeah, it's a show called Disturbing Innocence, and it's an exhibition of 52 artists from the 30s to the present who all work with dolls, toys, mannequins, robots as their primary form of expression. And it's a very disturbing show.
Deborah, what's that?
I hope the prices aren't disturbing, though.
It's not works for sale. This is come and enjoy.
Oh, that's the new. That is the new status sign in the art world. Brian, you should know that not for sale. Not for sale is a sales strategy in and of itself.
A sales strategy. An ironic sales strategy. Not for sale. A sales strategy in and of itself. We leave it there again with Deborah Solomon. By the way, her book is American Mirror, The Life in Art of Norman Rockwell, coming out in paperback next month. And Eric Fischel trying to sell his show by saying, it's very disturbing. That'll pack him in, Eric.
I hope so.
Thanks a lot. And we go out as we do with all the 25 Years and 25 Days segments with the number one Billboard song of the year, in this case 2006. Daniel Powder, Bad Day. Tell me your life's been way offline. You fall into pieces every time. And I don't need no care anymore. Cause you had a bad day.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show, celebrating 25 years in 25 days. I'm Carolita Johnson, the New Yorker cartoonist, calling from my studio in Inwood, New York City. Thanks.
And yes, for 2007 in our anniversary series, if you are familiar with the song you are now hearing, you will know it's the theme song to Mad Men, which made its debut in 2007 and will wrap up its final season next year. And whether you want to call it an official golden age of television or not, around the midpoint of the decade, the last decade, there was a lot of great TV out there. Besides Mad Men, The Wire was in its fourth and fifth seasons. Friday Night Lights was just beginning. The Sopranos ended that year. People were already saying that heralded a new age. Plus, the way we watch TV was changing dramatically. 2007 was the year that Netflix started allowing us to stream internet content at home. in the TV world. My next guest is the writer, director, producer, and creator of Mad Men, and he also wrote on The Sopranos. He is Matthew Weiner. Hey, Matthew, welcome to WNYC. So
great to be here, Brian. I'm glad.
And we can even take a few Mad Men questions on the phone if you want to call in and talk to Matthew Weiner today. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Now, I heard somewhere that that Mad Men theme was something you heard on a public radio station as one
that
of those interstitial.
Absolutely,
yes?
True.
Yes.
I actually think that David Chase heard the Sopranos theme on Morning Becomes Eclectic.
Really?
But so that was why I'm a public radio listener and supporter. And we have two stations in Los Angeles. I don't remember which one it was on, but I was listening to Marketplace. And, you know, you're talking about Netflix streaming starting after we came on the air. There was no Twitter. There was no iPhone. There was no iPad. I mean, this is only 7 years ago. And finding out what that song was that I heard was a huge pain in the butt.
Wow.
But my assistant at the time, who actually eventually became a writer on Breaking Bad, Jenny Hutchins, found it for me, tracked it down.
And what about that music said 1960s ad agency to you?
Well, I liked – we were already doing the animation for the opening, and I was trying to find the right song for it, and I was looking for something that kind of had a slightly historic feeling on it. But the whole vibe of the opening credits was that it was computerized animation, but it looked like an old title sequence. So we wanted to sort of mix the two things. So I was looking for something kind of modern, old-fashioned, and I also loved that it had the sound that sounded like falling to me. But when I heard it, I just assumed it was from a French movie or something, which is right in my sweet spot.
So we've got this whole confection of a concept that we're in a golden age of TV. But we read that just a few weeks ago at a Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit, you said that you don't believe in this notion and that it's just a marketing term. Is that your position?
You know, The Sopranos definitely changed the focus on television because it was artistically and commercially successful and superior to almost every other kind of entertainment out there. It suggested that a TV viewer would watch every episode, which was not the prevailing belief at that time. It suggested that people would stop whatever they were doing to watch it. It attracted incredible actors, many of whom were not famous when it started. And it was a – even though it was a limited – audience on HBO, it was this, as I said, international commercial success. So that definitely changed everything and certainly made Mad Men possible. I mean, AMC was definitely interested in me because I worked on that show and in this script, which I wrote actually the year that The Sopranos came out because of that. But I also feel like, you know, something about this golden age thing, it just irritates me because I'm a student of history and you know, there was a time, you know, just growing up, Mary Tyler Moore and MASH were on the air at the same time. And, you know, there's just like – there's always great TV and there's always crappy TV. And, you know, growing up and hearing people say, well, I only watch Masterpiece Theater and The Muppets. That was like – but I remember I was like, there was good TV on and TV has its own thing, which is especially notable now because it used to be that you watched it every week. And that sustenance and that familiarity. Anybody who's ever had a cold and gotten into some sitcom that they never heard of before and like, those are my friends. I'm going to visit them.
Yes, for the rest of the run of whatever series that was. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, but The Sopranos was the thing that really sustained the kind of soap opera, like continuing storyline thing. And that's what I think you're seeing in TV now.
And people had already started to binge watch seasons of shows on DVD because that technology was out there. And then they were able to record shows on DVR and do that at home without even buying the discs and sometimes two or three episodes or six or seven at a time. And people say that that led to more complex plots that could stretch out and didn't have to wrap up at the end of each episode and long character studies and some of this, you know, artistic success meets commercial success. Do you feel empowered by that to create deeper storylines?
I totally take issue with that. I think that, you know, serialized television, no one has a longer running storyline than General Hospital. I mean, it's really about do you like the characters and can you stay with them? What was the complexity of a story has nothing to do with the format it's in. And if anything, The Sopranos, you know, just take the first season of The Sopranos, which is kind of the defining moment for this whole whatever's happened since then, and you just take the storyline over the course of the season, it's a 13-hour story. that in itself was a breakthrough, but it didn't. Every single one of those episodes stands alone as a movie, and that was the goal of David. And you know, for me, I don't know. I mean, it's not like I don't. Nothing has changed. That's my philosophy. Nothing has changed except for the audience's appetite, and the binge watching thing in a way makes it worse in terms of storyline, because I think when you don't have a week to ruminate and you don't have a chance to watch it over again and let it sit with you, especially a show like ours that doesn't have a lot of plot, that the events are not sustainable and you have to keep upping the ante for a binge watcher in a way to keep it explosive. I never wanted the story to become that exaggerated.
So here's the one clip from Mad Men that we pulled for this conversation, which my producer thought exemplifies just the thing you're saying doesn't exist. So you can completely shoot this down.
No, all right.
Through Don Draper breaking down and actually telling the truth about his childhood at work, at a pitch meeting, in front of potential clients, and it only took him years to get to this point.
I was an orphan. I grew up in Pennsylvania in a whorehouse. I read about Milton Hershey and his school in Coronet magazine or some other crap the girls left by the toilet. And I read that some orphans had a different life there. I could picture it. I dreamt of it. Being wanted. Because the woman who was forced to raise me would look at me every day like she hoped I would disappear. Closest I got to feeling wanted was from a girl who made me go through her John's pockets while they screwed. If I collected more than a dollar, she'd buy me a Hershey bar. And I would eat it alone in my room with great ceremony. Feeling like a normal kid.
Pretty dramatic climax in the, you know, history of the whole Mad Men series. What would you say, anything you would say about that moment?
I think the moment depends on you knowing the whole show. And that's what I found was the difference about the way TV was being watched, which is that the networks had traditionally thought that a loyal viewer watched six episodes. You couldn't have a story arc unless you were a soap opera, and then you had to repeat everything over and over again. And the idea that we could pay something off that had happened 6 years ago, seven actually in the calendar, you know, was an incredibly gratifying moment. Now, it might have never happened that Don got to that point, but the fact that I got to do the show that long, I felt that that was... We've gone out of our way on the show to tell the ages of our characters, which a lot of times they don't on shows. They just sort of exist in a nebulous, you know, permanent age. And I think that as Don got older, we got to take advantage of where he was in his life. And that's why you get to tell that, come clean in that dramatic fashion.
And until we started this conversation, I would have said, see, that's an example of the way people can watch television these days, making a seven-year leap like that possible.
You're
until
right.
you said, but look at General Hospital.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's interesting to me that I try and make it. There was a thing that used to be said in the writers' rooms at the network TV, which is like, you know, Timmy. They would talk about Timmy, who was the idiot viewer, and Timmy doesn't like math, and Timmy won't remember that, and Timmy didn't see last week. And once The Sopranos was on, and people weren't watching six episodes, and you didn't have to redo the pilot every single week. That was the edict at the time when I started in television, like do the pilot every week. And actually, Seinfeld had this great continuing reference thing. You know, you knew if Jerry, you could get a laugh by season four if someone just held a Snapple.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of universe. And the Simpsons are you know, they have
Absolutely.
A complete universe. So that sort of, I guess, the attentiveness to the audience. I mean, now with all of this technology, the role that entertainment plays in our lives and what we get for free and what we pay for and our tolerance for the advertising that goes with it and all this is that's what's really changed, I think, in this TV universe.
Were you into 60s history that you decided to do, you know, to set the show the way it was?
I was into 50s history. And I really, on some level, besides being a man who was about the same age as Don when I wrote the script, which is really what it's about, and trying to tell an internal story, which is also what it's about. Like, you know, it's not necessarily it confounds the rules of cinema to basically tell a psychological story inside somebody's head. You're taught that that's impossible. And I thought, he's a regular person, not too many guns. Not too much, you know, but can I make this feel like real life? Can I make it feel like what happens when, like, you know, you walk out of your office and go into the bathroom and close the door and you're just like you're a different person? But the 50s part of it was really about imagining whatever the cliche of the 60s was that had been handed down to me. I'm from the 80s, so that generation was really on top of us and talking about how great it was as they gave up their idealism for loads of cash in the 80s.
And we have 30 seconds left.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No.
That's the short answer.
That's a great answer. And I'm just curious if the show is going to end because, you know, the story has to end. Like, Seinfeld couldn't have gone on forever with those people being single as they got older and older. Mm-hmm. Is there something about Mad Men that makes it have to end?
Well, you know, you want to the machinery that tells the story, the unexpected nature of the story, is going to get worn out. And there's so much guessing. But you know what? Honestly, I just wanted to quit while we were ahead.
And they certainly are ahead, as Mad Men is about to end. We will leave it there. We've been delighted to have Matthew Weiner, writer, director, producer, and creator of Mad Men. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, and happy anniversary.
Thanks a lot. And coming up, our panel on progress over the past 25 years from our live event at the Society for Ethical Culture with Gail Collins, David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, and Tavis Smiley. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Bridget in Mendham, New Jersey, and you're listening to 25 Years in 25 Days on WNYC.
Today, it's 2013.
It's been a long time coming. But today, Americans who have been forced to go without insurance can now visit healthcare.gov and enroll in affordable new plans that offer quality coverage. That starts today.
I've spoken throughout this campaign about a tale of two cities.
Well, I, sitting at my desk, certainly had the authorities to wiretap anyone, from you or your accountant to a federal judge to even the president, if I had a personal email.
Francisco, su nombre Francisco.
Su nombre Francisco es el primer papa de América Latina, el cardenal.
Remember 2013? Year of the Harlem Shake? In a minute, we'll play for you an extended excerpt of our 25th anniversary Big Think panel event held at the Ethical Culture Society in Manhattan with New Yorker magazine editor David Remnick, author and public radio and television host Tavis Smiley, and New York Times columnist Gail Collins. I had asked them each to bring one important thing that has changed in the last 25 years and one important thing that hasn't. David Remnick went first.
Well, I think one thing that's changed markedly is there's a tremendous change in the way minorities are viewed in this country in general. And the latest addition in a revolutionary way is gay rights. All of these things are incomplete. Civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, and a lot else. But that the progress made in 25 years cannot be denied. That is an enormous change. And since I'm the Russian guy on the stage, I look at the thing that I've been studying for 25 years. I was in Berlin when the wall was falling, and more to the point, I was living in Moscow permanently for years and years when this was happening, and I was deluded to think, as probably a lot of people in this room were, that the fall of communist ideology meant that there was going to be such a radical change in that part of the world to a kind of democratically driven sweetness and light, to be honest, that I still have memories of fireworks going off over the Moscow River as the coup fell in August of 1991. But a lot hasn't changed, and a lot has gone backwards, and there's a great deal of disappointment, and it's roughened my sense of the world in the same way that the very short-lived Arab Spring, which is something quite different, has roughened my sense of the world, or the optimism of 25 years ago about the Oslo Accords, and look at where we are now. So I think to view the world, as some people do, as an unalloyed march of progress is a childish illusion.
Gail.
I got to go for change with the internet communications, all those things. And in 89 or 90, a friend of mine from graduate school came to see me. I was just gone to Newsday then. And he said, he told me he had this new thing he was working on that involved the internet, and he was explaining this all to me, and I kept saying, Alan, 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 you're always doing these crazy things, you know. And I realized I would have been that person who said to, what, DeWitt Clinton, steam, you don't need steam, what the hey, people can row, you know. It's just, I would be wrong on everything. But to me, that's, and I see younger people who are simultaneously so much smarter than I was when I was their age, and even less attention, more attention challenged than I was at their age, and all that stuff and the connections, I mean, that's the big thing for change for me. And the not change thing, although I can't say it's totally unchanged, is I truly believe back then that by now we would have dealt with the fact that most families have a mother who works and that the kids need preschool, daycare, after-school care, all that stuff, which actually Congress... Yay. Which, you know, Congress did pass during the Nixon administration, and Nixon vetoed it, and we haven't had it back since. But I remember that era in 89. I was still at the Daily News, and I wrote a story about how Representative Chuck Schumer, he was then still in Congress, was the only member of Congress who had small children and a working wife. And he was the only one. He told me about it at great length, you know, but... And then I went to the convention in 80, in 90, or 88, I guess it was, in New Orleans when they nominated Bush. And I talked to all these young Republican guys, and they all had wives who worked. And they all kept, you know, they were all kind of thunderstruck by how the heck they were supposed to deal with this, the kids and the wife and the work. And I thought, wow, this is going to change overnight. This is going to be fantastic. And it still hasn't.
Mr. Smiley?
With regard to what hasn't changed, do you want my mildly provocative answer or my wildly provocative answer?
I'll go with the hot sauce.
You want the hot sauce? So this might sound strange, particularly on an occasion like this, but having done this for quite some time, not as long as you have done it, I am still disturbed after 25 years that public radio does not sound like America looks. It does not sound like America is. We've come a long way, and this is not an indictment on public radio alone, but it is the case that 25 years later, so many of our public institutions still do not look or sound like the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America that we live in, and we still have work to do, even as we celebrate great icons in this business like Brian Lehrer. There's still so much more diversity and inclusion that we are lacking in public radio and, quite frankly, on public television as well. So our public media has to do better. For those who don't know this, when you go home tonight, just Google, do a little reading about what Lyndon Johnson had in mind when he brought public television and public radio to bear. It wasn't to placate a particular and singular community. I won't give it away. Bill Moyers speaks more eloquently about this than anybody in the country, about what public TV and public radio were initially designed to do. Pardon my English, we ain't there yet. So that's what's not changed over the last 25 years. I think what has changed, to my mind at least, and I'm thankful for this, is that I think the evidence is starting to suggest that we are beginning to rethink the prison industrial complex in this country. I think we're finally starting to rethink the prison industrial complex, mandatory minimums, giving children life sentences, treating them as adults. I think we're starting to think that that whole process of what it means to be the country in the entire world that incarcerates more people than anybody else. So that's what hasn't changed, and I'm happy to say I think we're starting to change on that latter issue.
Do you want to react to that? You both brought up race in different ways. And actually, Tavis, did you think that David was being, you know, the too optimistic white guy looking
at race relations? I just want to...
Yes.
No. No. We don't disagree. I mean, the question is, has there been progress made? Has change happened? Yes. Is it even remotely sufficient? Not even close. I think we completely agree on that. We agree on the radio issue. We agree on the media issue. We agree on the prison issue. There's not a lot of space between us on that. Maybe performative difference, but actual difference in opinion, not really, no. But I have to say that it is foolish of us to not acknowledge, for example, in the area of gay rights, that somehow 2014 looks precisely like when you began your show in 1989. It doesn't. Are we anywhere near finished? No, nothing finishes. In fact, if I could make a larger point about this business of what's changed and what doesn't, something, maybe this is the process of being a little older than I was when I was covering these wildly optimistic things. The way the world works all too often and painfully, and the world is largely painful, even on a joyous celebratory night in your honor, Brian, which is exactly where it's happy to be. But these processes never change. They don't go straight forward. They go backward and forward, and they are maddening. Take the environment. What is happening in global warming is a tribute only to human and political stupidity. And when I have to hear Laura Walker say, and how the city will adjust to climate change, what a tragedy of political foolishness and stupidity.
The only thing I would challenge on that, David, and I think you're right, there's not much space between us on this or most issues. I respect David's work and agree with him on most things. But I think that what America suffers from is what I would characterize as a fairness fatigue. We suffer from a fairness fatigue. And so because we can't ever come to wrestle with the reality of not contesting the humanity of any of our fellow citizens, we can only put one particular group of persons out front at a time. And so you're absolutely right that we've made great progress on the issue of gays and lesbians being treated as they should be treated, as fellow citizens. But that doesn't mean that we've made progress for our Hispanic brothers and sisters. It doesn't mean that we have not regressed on the progress that was made for African Americans. And so that's why I say over 25 years, I mean, I hear your point. I think in theory I agree with you. I know what you meant by that. But Brian used a fascinating word a moment ago, optimism. So I think there's a difference between optimism and hope. Optimism suggests there's a particular set of facts, circumstances, conditions, something you can see, feel, or touch that gives you reason to believe that things are going to get better. I don't see that. Hope is something different. You know, I don't mean to proselytize, but, you know, one of my favorite Bible verses is that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. So I'm not an optimist, but I am a prisoner of hope. Even when you can't see it, that doesn't mean you can't believe it. I'm a witness that you can build an entire life on hope. So I'm always hopeful about the American experience. I'm always hopeful about our future. But if you were to ask me to give you three reasons why I'm optimistic that we're getting it right on brown people, that we're getting it right on black people, while we are at this moment getting it right or more right on gays and lesbians, there's a divide there. And what I'm trying to get at is a conversation about how we respect the full humanity, the full dignity, the integrity of every fellow citizen, not one group at a time for a space of time. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Gail, I know you wrote a book. You wrote a book on women's history, which probably included the fact that, you know, the men jump in and talk and the women wait to be called on. So, speaking on behalf of all women, which of course you're qualified to do, do you want to talk about women's progress, you know, because it specifically relates to the particular moment of conversation here?
Yeah, women...
the story of women over the last 50 years is just the most amazing story. And I mean, and you're talking about a vision of what a whole gender could do that existed for millennia. And suddenly, in my lifetime, that all changed. And that's just the best story I can ever tell. But when I talk and think about what women are up to today and what the problem, most of the problems, most of the places that it's not going to, it's not so much about sex as it is about class. Mm-hmm. It's poor women who are still really, really struggling. And frankly, it's the same thing for blacks, for Hispanics. For it's, you know, the problem for blacks and Hispanics is that there's a lot more of them on the bottom. But it's always about class. And frankly, I think the reason that we've had such spectacular, spectacular progress on gay rights lately is that most of the gay and lesbian people that America is seeing coming out are middle class. And it's join the party. I mean, so to me, you know, the big thing out there is not any of the old battles so much as the new one about class.
It's interesting, and I want to play the one soundbite I brought for this conversation, because on episode one of our series, 25 Years in 25 Days, I re-interviewed Francis Fukuyama, who in 89 had written that essay called The End of History, when he saw communism about to collapse and came up with the idea that it was the end of ideological history, that democracy and capitalism were like going to be the permanent, you know, end games of what humanity was heading toward. And there would certainly be a lot of debate within those and around the edges of those, but democracy had won all the ideological debates over the alternatives to that. Capitalism, that doesn't mean not manage capitalism, but capitalism had won the debate for good over that. So when I reread that essay a couple of months ago, I was really struck by one passage in it, which had said that a big reason for this is that they had basically, we had basically solved the class problem in the West. And that, exactly, okay, Karl Marx, there's no rationale for you to exist anymore because there's just going to be a growing middle class forever and ever. Well, to his credit, when we did our interview last month, he acknowledged that he got that part astoundingly wrong. And here is 30 seconds of Francis Fukuyama from that interview.
Since 1989, we've actually seen a very dramatic increase in economic inequality in the United States. And I would never make that statement today because I do think that actually, you know, the 1% and the 99% is probably one of the biggest social challenges we face, and that in fact, democracy is not going to survive if the de facto distribution of income continues to get skewed in this fashion.
So, Gail, that's a very strong statement, that democracy might not survive if we don't solve the 1% and 99% problem. Covering gridlock in Washington and writing about it, do you think that's a real threat in this country, or does that wildly overstate it?
I still think that most of the political division in this country traces back historically to the difference between crowded places people and empty places people, and that the way all this stuff is framed, it's all about the difference between us. If we walk out of our apartments and we look around, we see government doing useful things every minute, and understand how much we need government to keep things going. Mm-hmm. And if you're an empty place person, that's just not realistic. And that, to me, I like that argument and that difference because nobody in the difference is the spawn of Satan. You know, they're all working off of where they've come from. Right now, many people imagine that they're in empty places when they are not in empty places at all. But I think the thing is still relevant. So to that degree, I don't think the bottom groundwork of the country is broken. But our ability to solve problems right now is certainly in a really bad state. And I can't except for the idea that you have very, very rich people who have suddenly been let loose to spend as much money as humanly possible on these campaigns. Other than that, I can't quite explain it, because I don't understand a country where you have people every day, all day, everywhere. They want it to work, and they want people to get along. And then it seems very likely that next week Iowa is going to elect a woman who believes that people should be arrested for trying to enforce the Obamacare regulations as the person who's going to reach across the aisle and, you know, do things together.
So, Tavis, to that point, when I was in China 2 years ago, I met people who very earnestly argued that because of this chronic gridlock in the United States, that China's authoritarian system was actually more in the public interest than ours. And they argued, look, this isn't like, you know, Assad in Syria. This is an authoritarian government that really is interested in changing itself over every 10 years. They adhere to that system and developing its next crop of talent from within and trying to really work by and large on behalf of the interest of the people. And look at our economic growth compared to yours, et cetera, et cetera. We can actually get things done. And I don't know. Do you think that that could pose an ideological challenge to a chronically gridlocked democracy in which the 1% has all the money and the 99% increasingly sinks?
I'm glad you raised that, because I've been to China a few times over the years, and I find myself wrestling with that very notion every time I travel to that country. Because I think it is borderline hubristic on our part, and we're good about telling other folk how they ought to run their countries. And I think that when you talk about a country of 300 million people versus a country of billions of people, you have to have some leeway. I'm not talking about human rights violations now. Again, back to that notion of people having a right for their humanity not to be contested in this country and place else in the world. But you know, I want to be as open as I can be to the idea that what works for 300 might not work for 8 billion. They're two fundamentally different systems. And so I'm always, and I don't know that, and this is one of the things you'll never hear on public radio, public television, I don't know. I don't know on that, and I'm still noodling trying to figure that out. But if I can go back very quickly to what you asked of Gail about this notion of democracy, I want to take a slightly different tact on this, because Dr. West, Cornel West, and I wrote a book together a couple of years ago called The Rich and the Rest of Us, The Rich and the Rest of Us, A Poverty Manifesto. And we argue in that book, just a step beyond where Gail was, that poverty is threatening our very democracy. We argue in that text that poverty is now a matter of national security. These numbers in a democracy, now if we're going to be an oligarchy, let's call it that. If we're going to be a plutocracy, let's call it that. In a democracy, these numbers are not sustainable. 1% of the people cannot continue to own and control 40% of the wealth. The top 400 wealthiest individuals cannot have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million people. Back to optimism and hope. As long as folk are optimistic, you can do something with that. Or as long as people are hopeful, you can do something with that. In your democracy, when people lose hope, now you got a problem. I read a report not long ago, the Rasmussen report, that found that for the first time in years, 25 years or so, Brian, since they've been tracking this, for the first time ever, this report found, Rasmussen, if you want to read it online, that a slight majority of Americans for the first time think that the best days of this country are behind it. A slight majority of us think our best days are behind us. That's what I mean, giving up hope. When you start dealing with a population of people in this country who are hopeless and have no reason to be optimistic about anything in their future, put another way, when you have a population, I see this increasingly as I travel across the country, where there's so many fellow citizens whose, how might I put this, so many fellow citizens whose vulnerabilities outnumber their possibilities. That's real. Not just for black or brown folk, but white Americans too, where our vulnerabilities outnumber right now in 2014 our possibilities. That has to threaten a democracy long term, and I fear that whether it's our hubris or our arrogance or our patriotism that's now morphed for some of us into nationalism, our narcissism, I don't know, but for whatever reason, we won't even consider that history teaches me at least that there's no empire in the history of the world that at some point did not falter, fail, fall flat. It happens to every empire. But there's something about us that won't even let us consider whether or not we're getting close to the edge because we're America.
So, David, as somebody... as somebody who covered the fall of the Soviet Empire in and around 1989, do you think that Russia today is a cautionary tale in that after there was the dancing in the streets and et cetera, they have gone back to authoritarianism pretty much by choice, I think.
Not
it's
by
fair
choice.
To say
Not
that
by choice.
Putin is actually very popular. Maybe you disagree.
Well, there's no Brian Lehrer in Russia. And there's no New York Times, and there's no Tavis Smiley, and God help them, there's no New Yorker. There is a, in the Putin regime, increasingly, there is a closed information space that now is beginning to include the internet. It had not before. It does in China. And this is a huge, huge step backward. So when you talk about the popularity of an authoritarian leader, you have to take into account what that means in the context of a place where almost all the information, almost all the opinion is controlled by the dictator. Let's call it by its proper name. And I want to say one other thing about democracy. Democracy is not something you achieve like a baccalaureate degree. Uh-huh. Democracy is a process.
That's right.
Democracy is never fully achieved. It is a thing that we see in the near distance and we keep moving toward. If we are lucky, and we are in a million different ways in this often benighted country, by comparison of so many other places, extraordinarily lucky. And in so many aspects of modern life, we're lucky. Take I don't know if anybody in the audience has seen the television program The Nick, which is based on a hospital uptown and replicated medical conditions of just less than a century ago, just when you went on the air. Doctors didn't know how to do anything. Surgery was a matter of using shoelaces and no anesthesia, and people dropped dead the minute they got sick for the first time. They couldn't fix a hernia. And now we are blessed to live on a planet when at least the possibilities of nutrition and medical care and all these things are available to us. But what distorts it so terribly is the lack of democracy. And when there was a true democratic movement in terms of health care, however flawed, in this country, it met with enormous political resistance, and it still meets with enormous political resistance. And why? Because those people are bad or stupid? I don't think so. I just think that there are historical processes in this country that force us backward as much as they force us forward. These things are complicated beyond measure. And I just want to just add this complicating notion to what's going on.
But then, as a bottom line, do you accept Dr. Martin Luther King's dictum that
yes.
the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice?
When you are, there are days when I don't. When I, if I'm spending my time in Moscow, I do not feel that. Why would I? But, you know, security and stability is also a human urge. It's not the most liberal or radical urge, but it is an urge. And it's a necessity. So if you are Russian and lived through the 90s, when prices went out of control and a very small number of people became radically wealthy, and you started comparing your lifestyle not to your neighbor, but to those people in fashion magazines and on TV, and they were flouting it, and you began to realize that these companies were given over and state enterprises were given over to people with access to Kremlin power, you began not calling it demokratia, you called it democratia, democracy. You became completely alienated from the notion of democracy, and it became a bad word. And that is the step backward that started to lead, unfortunately, to Putinism. So no, I don't always believe that in every time, in every place.
And now we have to get the bleep machine out before we re-air this tomorrow. Tavis?
Now, if I can just take that King quote, it's a powerful quote from King, and practically everything he said is quotable. But King did say that consistently, repeatedly, that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it always bends toward justice. But that was not disconnected or divorced from his belief that the arc would only bend toward justice if we took seriously what he called the triple threat facing our democracy. And one of the points I try to bring out in the book that you referenced that I'm on tour for now, this Death of a King text, is that in the last year of King's life, and this is the first book that focuses just on the last year of his life, in the last year of his life, the story of King that we don't know is that everybody and everything in this country turned against him, and I mean everybody. When he came out against the war in Vietnam, he was at the Riverside Church with that Beyond Vietnam speech. April 4, 67, he gives that speech. They kill him 1 year to the day later, April 4, 68. Well, he advances a couple of notions in that speech that made everybody turn on him. And the first thing he said in that speech was that America was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. This is Dr. King telling America, you, America, are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And then in that speech, he advances this notion of what he calls the triple threat facing our democracy. And that triple threat was racism, poverty, and militarism. Racism, poverty, and militarism. As we sit here for this conversation tonight, celebrating your 25 years of doing this brilliant work, what do we see in Ferguson, Missouri, where we are either going to get an indictment or not get an indictment? What are we seeing 50 years later? Racism, poverty, and militarism. So that arc does bend toward justice if and only if we take seriously that triple threat the King tried to get us to deal with 50 years ago, but the truth that he was telling, I think, was so subversive that we couldn't handle it then and apparently still can't handle it now, that if we don't get serious about racism and poverty and militarism, our democracy once again is in trouble.
So let me take... So the next step, and we don't have all night to try to figure it out, but the next step is to ask how, Gail, because in that, if I had played the next minute of the Fukuyama clip, we would have heard him say that because we've entered this 1%, 99% era, and it is a threat to democracy, the challenge for the left in this country and around the world is to come up with new alternatives to free market capitalism as it has started to run rampant, because the old pre-1989 alternatives have so been declared over and something we don't want to go back to. So do you see the Occupy movement? Do you see something coming out of, I don't know what, de Blasio, Working Families Party, I don't know what, that's going to be different? That can change, that can get us back to the hope and change that people thought was going to come in 2009?
Yes, Brian, this is going to happen very soon, I know. Yeah, why not? Yes, yeah, sure, absolutely. You know, when I go around, you know, and there's so much sadness about the president now and how things didn't work out the way people expected, and I think back on the last 6 years or so, that original campaign between Obama and Clinton, which was the most interesting and exciting election I think I ever covered, but Barack Obama's side of it was so much about hope and so much about excitement, but it was actually based on a faulty premise, which was that you would get to the next step by simply being more reasonable and getting along with one another. And we know how that worked out. Really badly, really, really badly. But you have to, you know, there's the reaction against that now is partly a reaction against the fact that the president turned out to be much more conservative than a lot of people expected when it came to matters of economics and matters of business, the business community. And I think you're seeing another group, you know, they're all kind of squitching around Elizabeth Warren right now, but I think you'll see a bunch of people come up, and Elizabeth Warren will be coming up.
And actually, I think in 2008, and I'm not sure how much this was articulated at the time, he ran on kind of an impossible paradox, which was he was the one who was more progressive than Hillary Clinton, and he was the one who was more post-partisan at the same time. David, you're doubtful, but I'm not sure those two things can coexist.
They couldn't coexist. They were not coexistible. You cannot be not. You cannot say we can. I'm going to be farther left than you are. I'm more progressive than you are. But all we need to do is to go to the right and have a good conversation with them and come together in the middle, and we'll be at the more progressive place. There's just too many positions there. That doesn't work. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
No, I was just going to say on the question you asked, Gail, of the many ways one could answer that, I think one of the great step backwards, and it's not like we were in a great place on this anyway, is the infection, the complete disease of money in politics. And the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United is easily, in my mind, along with the rolling back of some civil rights legislation, where we are in voting rights, but this
giving
really,
Bush
really
the presidency.
And Bush v. Gore was a little bit of an error too. But Citizens United, the effect of you're going to see it, not only next week, but in years to come, and it's going to be very, very hard to change, is enormous. And so when I travel abroad, when I go to a place like Russia or China, and I'm sitting there speaking with officials, they very, very cynically say, look, you're talking about democracy. Look how your elections are. You're talking about our oligarchies here. Please explain to us the Koch brothers. Or please, and on the other side of the ledger, too. By the way, the Democratic Party is not immune from the blandishments of money. I followed Barack Obama around. This was the opportunity to interview him at great length for a piece that came out in January. And it was just amazing to watch the President of the United States going from city to city with a tin cup. There's a kind of element of humiliation in this, knocking on the door of one super wealthy person after another and speaking before the assembled dinner guests. There's something deeply, deeply wrong with this. And its effect on the way decisions are made and the decisions that are made can only be anathema to the United States.
Well, we haven't solved it yet. We may have a few months or years of conversation ahead of us yet to have before the world is a perfect place. But thank you all for having the courage to speak with ambivalence. And Tavis, thank you for having the courage for doing the thing that I call out guests on the air sometimes as one of the things that I most respect, saying, I don't know, to a question. Tavis Smiley, Gail Collins, David Remnick. And with that, speaking with the courage of their convictions, the courage of their ambivalences, the courage to identify what they don't know, that was most of the series-ending conversation that I moderated at the Ethical Culture Society with New Yorker magazine editor David Remnick, author and public radio and television host Tavis Smiley, and New York Times columnist Gail Collins. It was great to see hundreds of you out there, and especially to see my own parents, who have probably listened to almost every show for 25 years. Such is their undying love and support. If you happen to see my parents, tell them I said anything I've done right on this show for 25 years comes mostly because they raised me right. So thank you, Mom and Dad, and for making the effort to travel last night when it's been harder than usual lately. And as we conclude this series, 25 years and 25 days, and head into year 26, I want to thank a few people here at WNYC. Most of the year-by-year montages that you've heard in the series, and almost all the historical audio from the show and the rest of the world, was compiled by producer Alana Casanova Burgess, who worked tirelessly to find just the right things, along with producer Mary Croak, who did some of it too, and Andy Lancet and John Passmore from the WNYC Archives, whose names almost never get mentioned on the air, but who keep so much so well indexed with such grace. Jody Avergan produced the very fun and very deep event we had with sound and visuals and a sense of both what matters and what's funny. Karen Frillman, usually the enterprise editor for the news department, helped to give this series its shape and sensibility, along with news director Jim Schachter, acting executive producer Jen Poyant, who made sure it all hung together day by day, producer Lisa Allison is always making things better, and even our on maternity leave executive producer Megan Ryan, who chipped in with great ideas and guidance from her bleary-eyed but clued-in state of parenthood. WNYC President Laura Walker and Vice President for Content Dean Capello always set the highest possible bar for creativity and forward thinking and integrity, and that is so rare in the world of work, so thanks to them too. This show is a product of all those people all the time. Thanks again to our whole staff, to my parents, eternally to my wife Vicky, and to all of you who build this program with me every day for our first 25 years, and it's on to year 26. And as we go out, we are doing what we have done every day in the series with the number one Billboard song of the year in question for 2013. It was Thrift Shop by Macklemore with Ryan Lewis.
I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm hunting, looking for a come up. This is fucking awesome. I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you Monday. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
Rockin' the wolf on your noggin. What she knowin' about wearing a fur fox skin? Whoa. I'm digging, I'm searching right through that luggage. One man's trash, that's another man's come up. Whoa. Like your granddad, we're donating that plaid button up shirt. Cause right now I'm up in her upshirt. I'm at the Goodwill, you can find me in the I'm not stuck on searching in the section. Your grandma, your auntie, your mama, your mammy. I'll take those flannel zebra jammies secondhand and rock that.
Whoa.
The built-in onesie with the socks on them.